From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
In terms of your challenge in Miami-Dade, what is wrong with Republicans showing up at the election canvassing board and expressing their displeasure at the process?
Well, I think we all saw the videotape and audio recordings of that incident.
Mob politics. Who was in the crowd that stormed Miami-Dade election offices and prevented a hand count? We'll talk about some of the powerful Republicans who sent their congressional aides there. Also, a conversation with the Reverend Jesse Jackson, Slavery's Legacy, How Florida Shackled Thousands of Black Voters. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Three lawyers hired by the Republican leaders of the Florida legislature told a select committee yesterday that the Republican-dominated body was duty-bound under the United States Constitution to promptly call a special session to name Florida's 25 electors. Several Democratic and Republican legislators agreed that the carefully orchestrated testimony set in motion a process that virtually assures that the Florida legislature will meet in a special session to name its electors for George Bush. The Republicans hope to use the legislature to take the decision out of the hands of Florida's courts, where Vice President Al Gore's lawyers are challenging the decision by the Florida State Canvassing Commission that Bush won the state and thus its 25 electoral votes. Meanwhile, George W. Bush and his army of lawyers urged the Supreme Court to put its stamp of finality on the disputed presidential election or risk a constitutional crisis over the fate of Florida's decisive electoral votes. In court filings yesterday, the Republicans said Democrat Al Gore's court challenges to the election outcome threaten to drag out the process for weeks to come. If too much time passes, rival slates of electors could claim legitimacy in Florida, one with the imprimatur of the courts, the other name by the state legislature, they warned. But Gore's lawyers filed paperwork of their own, urging caution and calling Bush's charges groundless. The high court has scheduled arguments for Friday on Bush's claim that a Florida court improperly extended the November 14th state deadline for manual ballot recounts. And Vice President Al Gore yesterday officially defeated George Bush in Oregon, picking up that state's 7 electoral ballots in one of the last undecided contests in the hotly contested race for the White House. Oregon's election office certified the presidential vote in the state's first all-male election, saying that Gore beat Bush by 6,765 votes out of about 1.53 million cast. New Mexico, the other state that has not formally announced a presidential victor, yesterday delayed certifying results that appeared to favor Gore until a judge can check numbers from one county called into question by Republicans. And this news from Jerusalem. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak announced last night he is calling a general election after only 18 months in office. The push for early elections began in earnest yesterday when the hardline opposition presented 5 election bills for a vote. As it appeared increasingly likely that the legislation would pass in its first reading, Barak interrupted the proceedings with a surprise announcement that he was dropping his resistance and would agree to new elections. Reaching a peace agreement with the Palestinians in the next few months is now widely seen as Barak's only chance to get reelected. Thousands of Philippine protesters marched through Manila to the presidential palace today, carrying a giant effigy of President Joseph Estrada and calling for him to resign over corruption allegations. Though Estrada has been impeached and faces a Senate trial, he's refused to resign over allegations that he received millions of dollars in payoffs from illegal gambling and tobacco tax kickbacks. Yesterday, the Philippine Senate said it would begin the trial in December. 2 Republican senators came to the United Nations yesterday here in New York to say that the United States will demand a reduction in its UN bills no matter who heads the next administration, though Washington owes an estimated $1.8 billion in back dues. Congress approved legislation last year that would pay back only $926 million of the arrears, and the full check will be sent only after the 189-member General Assembly agrees to reduce the U.S. share of the administrative budget. Many countries, in particular those from the developing world, have been highly critical of the U.S. efforts to cut its share of the budget. And in a decision crucial to the fight against racial profiling, the Supreme Court ruled yesterday that Indianapolis police went too far in setting up random roadblocks for drug searches. The justices wrote that the checkpoints violated the Fourth Amendment protection from unreasonable searches and that the right to privacy outweighs police interest in catching drug criminals. Chief Justice William Rehnquist and Justices Antonin Scalia and Clarence Thomas dissented. And finally, former Congressmember Henry Gonzalez, a pugnacious and partisan Texas Democrat who used his perch as the chair of the House Banking Committee to champion public housing and tighter controls over the savings and loan industry, died in a San Antonio hospital yesterday. He was 84 years old.
And now, a message from Jeb Bush.
As GW's little brother, I can tell you he's got some great ideas, like there ought to be limits to freedom. I like that one. Checking out White House emails, I like that too. I guess I just like my big brother.
George W. Bush. He's not just running for president, he's running for Big Brother.
And you're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez.
Good day, Amy, and to our listeners around the country. And we continue with the watch of what is going on in Florida and what will happen with the presidency.
That's right. As the Washington Post said yesterday, but we'll add one day, 21 days and still not counting. Well, racing against the clock, a Florida judge moved swiftly yesterday to start work in Al Gore's legal challenge to the Florida certification of the presidential election that gave victory in the state to George W. Bush. Leon County Circuit Court Judge N. Sanders Saul set a hearing for Saturday. He also said he would order that thousands of disputed ballots, some 3,300 from Palm Beach County and more than 10,000 from Miami-Dade County, be brought to the state capital, Tallahassee, so they would be secure and ready if they need to be counted or examined. The Miami-Dade ballots had been set aside last week to be counted by the county's election board, which had flip-flopped several times over whether to conduct manual recounts. But last Wednesday, a group of Bush supporters stormed the office of the Miami-Dade Supervisor of Elections, where the counting was to take place, demanding that the recounts be stopped. According to witnesses and news accounts, people were trampled and kicked. Just a few hours later, the Miami-Dade Canvassing Board abruptly canceled all manual recounts, and David Leahy, one of the board's members, acknowledged to the New York Times that the protests were, in fact, that he had weighed in the decision. Well, it turns out that the protests may have been planned and orchestrated by Republicans in Washington. Among those protesting were staff members of Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott of Mississippi and Tom DeLay of Texas, as well as prominent Cuban Americans. We're joined right now by a reporter who is there. Don Finifrock is staff reporter for the Miami Herald. And also Francisco Arruca joins us, who is host of Radio Progreso in Miami. Don Finifrock, let's start with you. What happened exactly that day? A lot of people have seen the videotape and heard the audio tapes, but can you explain what you saw?
Good morning. The canvassing board had met a little bit after 8 o'clock that morning to decide how it was going to handle the recount after the Florida Supreme Court had decided to set a Sunday deadline. And the board voted to abandon the full recount and go forward with a partial hand count of just the undervote ballots, those ballots that showed no vote for president. There were approximately 10,750 of them. And it decided to adjourn up to the 19th floor to the tabulation room in the elections department that's tucked away behind closed doors. When the board adjourned to the 19th floor, there were Republican observers who had been following the count in the public conference room prior to Wednesday morning's vote. They followed the board up to the 19th floor, and when they were denied access to the counting room, the tabulation room, that's when the protest began.
Now, In terms of the counting in that room, were there any observers of either of the political parties there, or was it just a canvassing board and their staffs?
No, there were observers. The canvassing board brought two observers from each party, the Democrats and the Republicans, into the canvassing room with them. And there were accommodations made for reporters. The tabulation room has a set of windows. It's at the back of the elections department, again, on the 19th floor. There are a set of windows, and there were several television cameras and print reporters standing on the outside, and we were able to observe what the canvassing board was doing inside the tabulation room.
So that some of the allegations that we've been hearing that they were basically trying to work in secret are not accurate. There were other independent observers or observers of the parties as well, the press in the room.
No, the board wasn't seeking to work in secret. The reason they had gone to the tabulation room is because they needed to run some ballots through the county's counting machines. They needed to separate out undervotes from 109 precincts that hadn't been separated earlier. And then they needed to run all the ballots back through the counting machines after the board had looked at each and every undervote. They felt it would be more efficient and they'd be better equipped to meet the Sunday deadline if they conducted the count in that tabulation room. The problem was it's a small room with very limited access for the press and the public. And the Republican observers who were outside the elections department in the lobby found the doors to the election department locked, as they always are. There is not public access to the elections department, as you can imagine. But finding themselves shut out, they then began a protest. They began chanting, stop the count, stop the fraud, democracy now. They pounded on the doors and the windows, the glass windows of the election department, and they sought to pull open the doors. When the doors were open to let observers or news reporters into the elections department, the crowd pulled on the doors, seeming to force their way in.
This is how Paul Gigot put it in the Wall Street Journal. He said, if it's possible to have a bourgeois riot, it happened here on Wednesday in Miami. It could end up saving the presidency of George W. Bush. And he went on to say, street smart New York Congressman John Sweeney, a visiting GOP monitor, told an aide to shut it down and semi-spontaneous combustion took over. The Republicans marched on the counting room en masse, chanting three blind mice and fraud, fraud, fraud. True, it wasn't exactly Chicago 1968, but these are Republicans. Their normal idea of political protest is filling out the complaint card at a Marriott. They also let it be known that 1,000 local Cuban Republicans were on the way, not a happy prospect for Anglo judges who must run for re-election. The canvassers then stunned everybody and caved. They canceled any recount and certified the original November 7th election vote, claiming that the Sunday deadline didn't allow enough time to recount everywhere. Republicans rejoiced and hugged like they just won the lottery. Francisco Arruca, can you tell us who these 1,000 local Cuban Republicans they were threatening to have come were?
carried out, rather, in the back room. I'm not sure that they were aware of anything that was happening on the street or on Cuban radio. But certainly they knew that there was a protest on the 19th floor, and I think that influenced their decision to move the count back to the 18th floor at County Hall, where the count had been conducted since Monday. There's a very large public conference room on the 18th floor with ample room for reporters and anyone from the public who wished to observe the process. The board, after about a half an hour of the protest, agreed to reconvene on the 18th floor, and that decision was announced to the crowd of Republican observers outside the election department's offices. Now, I think that decision proved critical because once they decided to move back to the 18th floor, I think the board itself started to have second thoughts about whether they could meet the deadline set by the Florida Supreme Court. And in a press conference after the decision, the vote was taken to abandon the recount altogether. David Leahy, who is the election supervisor and one member of the canvassing board, said that he became convinced that if the board was forced or obliged, really, to run two operations at once, in other words, to count ballots by hand on the 18th floor and then adjourn to the 19th floor to watch as the ballots were run through the counting machines, that it became logistically impossible. They couldn't meet the Sunday deadline. So I think the decision to move back to the 18th floor provided the opening for the board to reconsider its decision. And once that decision was made to reconsider, I think that the pressure of the moment and the protest probably played a role in the decision of the board to call off the recount.
And what's the relationship?
Can I add something?
Yes, sure.
Let me add something. Because
Francisco.
Yes. I am pretty sure that it was in Don Feinfrock's article also. As a matter of fact, a lot of information I have been using in my program comes from Don's articles. He's been providing terrific information. But I want to mention something that came out, and I'm pretty sure it was in his own article. Leahy, who is the head of the election board and was member of the canvassing board, had already told the New York Times in an article that appeared last Friday that indeed these activities and these protests led him to change his attitude. Later on, he told Don Feinfeld for his articles in the Herald that wasn't true. What obviously remains to be seen here is who said the truth. If Leahy, when he talked to the New York Times on Friday, or somebody got to Leahy after supposedly saying that to the New York Times, and Leahy changed his tune when it came to the Miami Herald because he knew what could cost him in Dade County if he kept saying, yes, I changed my decision because of what was going on Wednesday. So supposedly he did tell the New York Times that, and I'm pretty sure it was Don himself who reported that in his article in the Miami Herald after it had been published in the New York Times.
Francisco Rucca and Don Feinfrock, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. We want to ask you to stay on with us for one more minute after the break as we talk about the Republican near riot. I could only think what would happen if it was African Americans who had punched out people and stopped a recount, what would happen. After that, we're going to be talking with the Reverend Jesse Jackson and looking at a piece in the Village Voice today on the disenfranchisement of thousands of African Americans, again looking at Duval County and where is Al Gore in all of this. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, back with the Miami Herald reporter and the Radio Progresso host, Francisco Rucca, in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez as we finish up with the Miami Herald reporter Don Finifrock, as well as Francisco Ruca, host of Radio Progreso in Miami, one of the few progressive Cuban radio programs there. And I know he has to go off to his program in just a minute. Juan?
Yes, I'd like to ask Don Finifrock one last question. In terms of the canvassing board and its relationship to the other political structures in Miami-Dade, there's two independents, one Democrat. How close are they to the mayor there, Alex Spinelles, and how subject would they be to political pressures on such an important issue as this?
Well, one member of the board is election supervisor David Leahy. Technically, he works for the county manager. The mayor is the head of the government, but he doesn't actually run the government on a day-to-day basis. The county manager is responsible for that, and the county charter specifically prohibits the mayor from interfering in personnel matters. So you have David Leahy, a county employee, who works for the county manager on the board, and then you have two county judges, and they were both appointed by the chief judge for the 11th Judicial Circuit. That's the state court here in Miami-Dade County. And so they would be independent. But, of course, those two judges are also elected. They, in fact, were both reelected in November without opposition to six-year terms. So they'll be up for reelection in another 6 years.
I just think it's quite astounding when you think about what happened. And in the end, how little coverage it actually got. I know it got a lot of TV coverage. You saw the video, Little Riot. But when you look, I mean, in the New York Times, their description of it, upstairs in the Clark Center, several people were trampled, punched, or kicked when protesters tried to rush the doors outside the office of Miami-Dade Supervisor of Elections. Sheriff's deputies restored order when the ruckus was over. The protesters had what they wanted, a unanimous vote by the board to call off the hand counting. And this congressional staff aide sent down from Washington, from DeLay's office, from Lott's office, and through force, they got what they wanted. Francisco Ruca, final comment.
Let me add to what you just said here, and that is, it is interesting. You even mentioned before what would have happened if these had been black Americans. Although I cannot tell you whether the majority of those who were involved in the riot were Cuban Americans or were Republicans from out of town, there was participation of Cuban Americans. That is obvious from the pictures that you saw, even in the Herald itself. But I want you to realize that the situation in Miami is very touchy when you cover the Cuban-American community. These events took place Wednesday. The reporting, particularly the fine reporting of Don Finifrock, starts taking place on Thursday. It is not until Sunday, okay, just 3 days ago, it's not until Sunday that some connection between Cuban-Americans and what happened there Wednesday come up, precisely when they report that the contact person for the Republican Party to organize protests against the manual counting is another Cuban-American who lives here in Coral Gables and who used to work at an unidentified firm in Washington, D.C., convincing heavy investors to invest in Cuba once Castro was gone. That is, for several days, as a matter of fact, even for 2 days after the Wall Street Journal had already brought up the Cuban-American element in those 1,000 Cuban-Americans that were threatened to be brought into the building, it was not until Sunday that a reference is made to Cuban Americans. So I wanted to emphasize that because I totally agree with you that if this had been done by African Americans in the opposite direction, believe me, the reporting would have been much more, in my opinion, clear in many aspects.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us, Francisco Ruca, host of Radio Progreso in Miami, and Don Finifrock, staff reporter for the Miami Herald. And again, yesterday Al Gore did address the nation again briefly, and then in the question-answer period, a few reporters outside did ask him about what happened, but he clearly didn't want to go into it.
In terms of your challenge in Miami-Dade, what is wrong with Republicans showing up at the election canvassing board and expressing their displeasure at the process?
Well, I think we all saw the videotape and audio recordings of that incident, and I think everybody can make his or her own judgment about it. But that question is going to be decided, or at least looked at, by the court in Tallahassee. The more important question is, why not count all the votes? As I said last evening, This is America. When people vote, their votes are counted.
Al Gore speaking yesterday. Today, the Village Voice came out in New York, and one of its lead columnists is James Ridgway. He does a column called Mondo Washington. He has an interesting email from GOP high command to troops, which says, if the vote count affirms Bush's election, we allow a short grace period to see the reaction of the Gore camp. If they have not graciously conceded after a few hours, we must bombard the news media and our public officials at every level with phone calls of outrage that demand Gore's concession, literally millions of phone calls. We must jam their phone banks with calls. There are millions of us, so it shouldn't be too difficult. If it becomes widely reported, and it will, that there's a groundswell demanding Gore back down and not embarrass the country, it'll be very difficult for Gore to withstand the pressure. He will have to relent. Again, an email from GOP high command to troops. Jim Ridgway, can you say more about this?
Well, that came, we've sort of boosted up our website during this whole election thing. We're putting stuff out all day long. So we have a lot of new readers, I think, who are sending us stuff. And we have a lot of stuff that just comes in, and that came in from someone who was, put out. So that's where that's come from.
You also write about the Democrats and how they're dealing with Al Gore right now and fitting it into the House and the House and Senate races. The House now ahead. Republican has one seat more than Democrats, and the Senate divided. What is happening there?
Well, you see, I don't think you can do this on the basis, figure it out on the basis of these parties, because in a lot of ways these parties are, you know, not very substantial. What you've got are all these kinds of coalitions in the Congress that cut across left and right lines. I mean, on trade, you have liberals with, you know, people on the far right. World Bank, you have the same kind of coalition. You have the Blue Dog Democrats or conservatives, you know, joining with conservative Republicans and various pieces of legislation. And even these new Democrats, the Clinton Gore kind of Democrats, they're not that far away from the Blue Dog Democrats. So it seems to me that Bush, if he is in fact elected, might be able to have coalitions of one sort or another that might pass some of what he wants to do. I mean, I don't think he wants to do very much, but I think that that's at least conceivable. He's also new, fresh, you know, a fresh face, and even though his advisors have all been here before, apparently, seems to be the people around him are, you know, seasoned veterans of his father. But Al Gore and Clinton have always made people in the Congress mad. So it's always possible that Bush can put together these kinds of coalitions.
Now, you also have in this week's Village Voice, along with Laura Conway, who's joining us here from The Voice, an article on the situation of voting rights problems in this election, particularly in the African-American community. And I know that in your article you touch on Duval County in particular, which I wrote a column about that about 10 days ago in the Daily News, raising some of the issues of what was happening in Duval County. But I'd like to welcome Laura also to the show, and if you could tell us a little bit about what's your article, How Florida Shackled Thousands of Black Votes, tries to touch on.
Well, one of the things that I think has been really striking in the developments in Florida is that you have hundreds of hours of testimony from people saying, I was kept from the polls, I was not given the assistance I needed at the polls. And as soon as everything started focusing on counts and recounts, everyone, all the politicians, even the most progressive media, I thought, really jumped in and said, we can't really trace all this civil rights stuff down, so forget it. We're just going to count and recount and argue about whether the holes on the Palm Beach ballot were in the right place. And to me, when the real tipping point for me was when Salon came out and said, what we should do is we should have a hand recount of the whole state and then just forget everything else. I thought, well, that's great if you're one of the people whose ballot actually got in the box.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, it's how can you say that it's a that it solves everything to count and recount the existing votes. When you have so much testimony from people in the Haitian American community, from people in African American communities all over Florida, who either A, were turned away from the polls, you know, they set up sheriff roadblocks out front running ID checks and all that kind of thing, or you have people in Duval County where the functional illiteracy rate is 47%. I mean, we're talking about people who were either disenfranchised in the act of trying to vote or who were disenfranchised by education long before they ever reached the age of majority. And to me, the idea that all these candidates who are running themselves as you know, Bush, the compassionate conservative, Gore, let's keep affirmative action, Nader, let's run for the people, who is down there saying we have to do something when there's a county where 47% of the people can't read a magazine? And after this happened, they said nothing. They said nothing. Gore won the support of black people in Florida by ratios as much as 10 to 1. But when they started coming out saying, you know, this is wrong, we've been treated wrong. I mean, you can look at Duval County. The black mortality rate for infants is twice as high as for white people. And I don't see how Gore can get that much support from a community, can depend on them so heavily, and then just split when they need him.
Well, one of the things about Duval County, I think, that is critical, at least from the information that I got when I did my column last week, was that there were 27,000 ballots invalidated in Duval, 9.3% of all the ballots cast. And in some black precincts, as many as 30% of all the people who went to the polls had their ballots invalidated. Either by so-called overvoting or undervoting. But the New York Times piece, which came out the same day as my column, made a critical mistake in that they claimed that this was as a result of the fact that Democratic Party people told the voters to vote on every page and that the presidential ballots was actually spread over two pages, when in fact it was a sample ballot that the county produced, which was mailed to voters and which was at every polling place, that told the voters to vote on every page. And so in essence, you had not only do you have, as you say, the literacy problem that you're talking about, but then you also had a confusing ballot, not the butterfly problem that you had in Palm Beach, but a ballot that was contradictory to the actual content of the ballot itself. So if you're not able to read well, you would have the double problem then of having that situation. So I think that that was compounded in addition by the fact that it was an all-Republican canvassing board, and they withheld from the Democrats the fact that there were 27,000 votes until almost they only found out about it 2 hours before the deadline for applying for a manual recount.
One of the things, actually, I have to say that has really bothered me a lot in this election is that so much of it, look at the situation with the butterfly ballot in Palm Beach County. What do the Republicans say? Well, the Democrats approved the ballot. You know what? The parties don't get to decide whether the voters have a chance to vote on a ballot that makes sense. They don't. And part of the reason
they shouldn't.
They shouldn't. Right. They should not be allowed. You know, whether or not you get a ballot you can read or an education you can, you know, live on, it should not be determined by a Republican organizer or a Democratic organizer. And I think that, you know, we really see that in the case of the African-American plight in Florida because they've been abandoned by the parties.
Now, Laura Conway, you yourself grew up in Mississippi.
I did. I'm in disguise, but I did.
Florida is what's contested right now, but certainly African-Americans being disenfranchised goes well beyond the borders of Florida.
Oh, that's absolutely true. And I think that one of the things that has happened is that people have gotten very good at turning out the vote. So you see an increased black turnout. What you get is a white backlash against that, and you see that in particularly in conservative resentment of, you know, church groups getting, you know, African-American church groups getting their members together and coming in on the bus to vote, because the white vote feels very much, held hostage to the black vote, particularly in state and local races. And I think that One of the things I was really struck by was the white Republican governor of Arkansas actually got on Don Imus and complained that black churches were bringing in black voters as though they were cattle on a truck. And I think the black vote is still seen as a commodity in a lot of ways, and for white conservatives, it's a dangerous one.
We're also joined on the telephone by Erla Fari Hutchinson, who's a columnist and journalist speaking to us from Los Angeles and has been repeatedly been writing about the disenfranchisement of African Americans in the voting booths. One of his pieces, Bamboozled at the Voting Booth, Republicans Trying to Brush Off Allegations That Some Blacks in Florida Were Cheated Out of Voting, Is Groundless Paranoia, But the Past 100 Years of Southern History Gives African Americans Plenty of Reason to Wonder. Erla Fari Hutchinson, welcome to Democracy Now!
Well, it's always a pleasure, Amy and Juan.
It's great to have you with us. We hope to be joined by the Reverend Jesse Jackson in a few minutes, and you also have been talking about how he has been dealt with in the media as he tries to bring up the issue of violations of the Voting Rights Act and disenfranchisement of African Americans as well as other people of color in Florida.
Well, yes, and we've just seen that again yesterday. As you know, not just Jesse Jackson, but all national leaders from the Congressional Black Caucus all the way down to some of the Florida State legislators and community groups, local community leaders in the Miami-Dade County area, they've had a number of protests, a number of demonstrations, and as late as yesterday, they had a press conference, once again, looking at the issue of not just irregularities and peculiar ballots, but out-and-out fraud. So essentially what's happened is we've seen two things. Number one, the leadership has been there. They've raised the issue over and over again. They've gotten sworn testimony, affidavits, a lot of letters and testimony from individuals that they, in fact, were victimized at the polls and, in fact, before they even had a chance to get to the polls. But then we saw something else. We saw a backlash. I heard that word used in reference to many whites around the country, conservative whites, who reacted to the overwhelming turnout of African Americans at the polls in many places. We've also seen a media backlash, too. If you, in fact, do a little viewer surfing, MSNBC, Fox News, CNBC, you see commentators and pundits, you know, just having a field day with Jackson, Mfume and the NAACP, Sharpton, saying, what are they doing down there? Here they're whipping up, they even use that term, they're whipping up the mob. They're playing the race card. We hear that over and over again. They don't need to be down there. They're making a bad situation worse. So essentially what's happened is they've poisoned the climate. They have polluted the dialogue. They have prevented many, many persons from around the country to really look at the issue beyond just a strangely configured ballot or irregularities, if I'm going to be charitable when I use that term. But, in fact, the key question that you had literally thousands and thousands of African Americans that never got to the polls for a variety of reasons. That is the real story, and that is a story that's being universally not only missed, but essentially deliberately distorted.
Erla Fari Hutchinson and Laura Conaway, we have to break for stations to identify themselves, but we'll be back with you and hopefully the Reverend Jesse Jackson, who is in New York and will be holding a news conference today on this very issue. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez as we talk about who gets to vote and who hasn't, who's been focused on and who hasn't, who's been vilified for focusing on those that haven't gotten to vote or haven't been counted. and who hasn't. We're joined by Laura Conaway and James Ridgway. They have the cover story of today's Village Voice called Slavery's Legacy, How Florida Shackled Thousands of Black Votes. And we're joined on the telephone from Los Angeles by Erla Fari Hutchinson, columnist and journalist who's been writing extensively on this issue. Juan?
Yes, well, I'd like to bring James Ridgway back into the discussion. Interestingly enough, there was a noontime conference meeting yesterday of all the executive committee of the AFL-CIO with the Democratic vice presidential candidate, Joe Lieberman. And Lieberman gave the AFL executive committee an update, whereupon he left the conversation and they decided finally to take some more public action. They're calling they're joining in with other civil rights and religious groups to have a demonstration outside the U.S. Supreme Court on Friday when the court holds its a hearing on this case. But interestingly enough, from what I've been told, the Gore people have been trying to discourage any kind of public protests by their followers. They really have not sought to mobilize their supporters in the way that the Republican Party has, and they effectively have placed their fate in the hands of the courts and in their lawyers. And I'm wondering what your sense is from what you are reporting on in Washington.
Well, that's the way they've been doing it all along. They micromanage this stuff to the point where they don't know what they're doing themselves. I mean, let's take Cleveland, for example, which has a huge potential Democratic vote. All those people wanted in Cleveland, the people who ran the Gore campaign, begged and pleaded with them to let them have Clinton come out and address these people, which would galvanize them and get them to vote. And they refused. They wouldn't let Clinton, go. And they wouldn't even send anybody, there was a note that anybody would know. So they're constantly playing everything down, playing it close to the vest. It's sort of this new Democrat style. It's not inclusive. This party, such as it is not an inclusive party anymore. It's these guys in Washington who are functionaries and who are lobbyists and have got a lot of money in some cases, and the other people, for all everyone talks about it, they're really not part of it. They're just dragged into it when it serves the purpose of the guys in Washington. That's the case with the African Americans and the Haitians.
Something on that.
Earl Afari Hutchison.
Two things. One, just on the Clinton thing. Out here in L.A., 2 days before the election, if you can picture this scenario, Al Gore came to Westwood, Beverly Hills, and Santa Monica. They had a major area rally in Westwood, which drew in the west side of Los Angeles, primarily white, middle class, upper income, and a lot of students, too, UCLA and a couple of the other universities. 4,000 or 5,000 persons showed up. Al Gore, the centerpiece, I think Lieberman was here too, the centerpiece of the rally. The same day, the exact same day at the exact same hour, not more than 3 miles away in south central Los Angeles, Bill Clinton came to Los Angeles. Literally, there were 10,000 African Americans and Latinos. I got to tell you, they just really just packed not only the arena where Clinton came, but also the whole shopping center and all the surrounding streets around there. I mean, it was just a sight to behold. Now, think about that for a minute. Almost a stone's throw away, Al Gore, from Bill Clinton, literally triple the crowd that Al Gore got, not only the crowd, the numbers, but also the base constituency of the Democratic Party, African Americans and Latinos. Al Gore, Bill Clinton, they may as well have been on the moon and the sun. No connect whatsoever. I mean, it was just absolutely insane to see that. And by the way, that was commented on over and over again, not only by many in the media, the local media, but also, and it did not escape notice of many African-American and Latino state legislators and political officials that were there, too. Just one other thing, too, about the distancing. If you notice, back on the point about voter fraud, not just allegations, but out-and-out voter fraud involving thousands of African-Americans, One of the reasons why Jackson, Mfume, and others have been absolutely trashed in the media, and one of the reasons why much of the media has not even paid attention to the issue, is because of Gore and the Democratic Party. I blame them, and I'll tell you why. Because the media has taken their cue from, mainstream media has taken their cue from them when they said that we have four or five lawsuits down here by African-American and Latino voters, specifically on the issue of vote fraud. The Democratic Party, the hierarchy led by Al Gore, the signal from Gore said, we are going to distance ourselves from those lawsuits specifically because we don't want to bring race into it. We're just going to focus on essentially the ballots that got counted or didn't get counted in those two counties. The media took its cue from that. It took the signal from that, and then it was a green light to trash African-American leadership or ignore them on the issue of vote fraud.
So could I answer that? I mean, that's absolutely right. That's fantastic. What you said is absolutely the way it is as far as I'm concerned. And the other thing is, that's going on right now, is that the Bush people very cleverly got a PR operation going. So what you have now is you have these polls, and the polls are showing that, oh, Gore should quit and Bush should come in. And then, of course, the more you do the polls, the more you get another poll that'll say even more than the first poll said. So you can't lose with this. And the guys who are doing the polls are the same people who screwed up the election, ABC, these networks. So things are no longer in the election mode. They're in the polling mode again.
Well, I'd like to bring in Laura Conway again in terms of this whole issue of disenfranchisement, because I think that a lot of people in other parts of the country really don't understand how the Jim Crow laws worked in the past and how they may actually were working here in Florida at this, in this election, because the whole thing about the Jim Crow laws that they were actually the laws at the time. So it was legal. There were legal ways found to keep down the black vote. For instance, this whole issue of the photo ID, the card that you need, that was only recently passed, as I understand it, by the Florida legislature in time for this election. Because when you go on to all of the web pages of all of the county election boards, it says now you need a photo ID card to be able to vote. So this was a new thing that was passed. The firm that you talk about that purged thousands of convicted felons from the voter rolls, even though Florida has had the law that a convicted felon can't vote for life, they didn't really initiate a purge, a massive purge of the voter list until this summer. And then they got a whole lot of people wrong who were on those lists. So a lot of these laws were in preparation for this presidential election.
I think really that you can talk a lot about, you know, the specifications of ballots and all the party wrangling, but you can't really get too far away from the sort of the overall context of race in America, and particularly in the South. And the thing I was, when you mentioned Jim Crow, whenever I go home to Mississippi, I like to go up into the Delta and kind of get away a little bit. And still, when you walk in a little country store, I often find that if there's a line and there are a couple of African Americans ahead of me in line, they'll get out of the line and let me go first. And I think that there's a whole range of African-American experience that we as white people, particularly, I mean, the Village Voice is, you know, fairly integrated newspaper, but it's still essentially a white publication, that we don't even know. I mean, we can't begin to know what it's like to try to go to the polling place and see sheriff lights out front. You know, we just don't know about it, and I think you can't overestimate its impact on the electorate and on this particular election. When you're talking about a vote that's hinging on, you know, what are they saying now, 537 ballots. I mean, there's no question to me that there were thousands and thousands and thousands of African Americans in Florida who went to the polls to vote for Gore and either didn't get there or had a botched ballot.
And I would even add something else too.
Earl
that
Farr,
when you go back to Florida and also 10 other states too that bar for life ex-felons from voting, one of the things that came up in the testimony, which was documented by Kwesi Mfumi at the NAACP when they had the hearings in northern Florida, was essentially the ex-felon rule, that what happened was that a number of individuals apparently did go to register, did attempt to register, and one of the questions that some of the registrars in some of the counties in northern Florida especially asked, had you been convicted of a felony before? Now, many of the individuals had no record whatsoever, had never been in trouble with the law, were model citizens and so forth. But even asking the question had a chilling effect. So whether you're an ex-felon, banned for life under Florida law or not, or just asked the question by a registrar, it had an intimidating effect. And this is one of the other things that, other than the NAACP and the testimony that was held in several places, no one is talking about.
We're talking about black disenfranchisement, the Voting Rights Act. Also, the news that we had earlier this week that there were going to be civil lawsuits that were brought for the violations of the Voting Rights Act, but we haven't seen that at this point. I want to point out, though, that Medea Benjamin, we had her on more than a week ago, and she was commenting, being one of the counters in Florida. She had run for the Green Party on the Green Party ticket for Senate in California. How it was very clear to her as she was there in Florida that it was the Democratic machine, apparatus, the unions, everyone else that were preventing people from going to the streets and saying not to mobilize and driving Jesse Jackson out.
Well, and for instance, I would ask all of our listeners to pick up your daily newspaper today in your hometown, wherever you are in the country, and see if you see an article about the meeting that Janet Reno held yesterday with John Conyers, with Charlie Rangel, with several other African-American leaders, where they were formally requesting her to initiate a voting rights investigation. I'm willing to bet, I've only seen a few papers here in New York City, but I'm willing to bet that you will see no coverage of that meeting or of that request. And there was almost no request of the Congressional Black Caucus letter to the Justice Department of a few days ago, also requesting that investigation.
Well, we are joined right now on the telephone by the Reverend Jesse Jackson, who is in New York. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez, and we have a host of people on the telephone, Earl Afari Hutchinson in Los Angeles, Jim Ridgway, and Laura Conway of the Village Voice. What you're talking about right now with the civil rights violations and the violations of the Voting Rights Act and why they're not being raised, including by the Democrats.
Well, see, I want to call this the third rail. If Bush is one rail and Gore's another rail, civil rights is the third rail. It's the hot rail. It's the rail with the electricity in it. No party really wants to grapple with the third rail. We went to Selma to get the right to vote in 1965. Neither party supported nor led the drive for the right to vote in Selma. It was the hot rail because it's the race rail. And in Florida, it is easier to talk about Chadism than racism. And the reality is, you look at who got disenfranchised, it's about 85 to 90% African American, plus Hispanic-speaking farm workers, immigrants, Americans, and Haitian Creole-speaking Americans, and the cadre of maybe 20,000 of senior citizen Jewish Holocaust survivors in West Palm. But what you're going to find, corruption in Seminole County and in Martin and St. Lucia, Fort Pierce, you're going to find intentionality, as in targeting. You're going to find race profiling. And it is that rail that the Department of Justice must address. They fought the Elion. It was the right thing to do. Justice has been too silent on the issue of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act being violated in Florida.
Well, Reverend Jackson, I know when I talked to you several days ago, you talked about your experience at the deadline for registration and the thousands of African-American students, I think it was at Florida A&M. Can you tell us about that rally?
Florida A&M in Tallahassee, Bethune-Cookman in Daytona Beach, Edward Waters College students in Jacksonville. They went to vote. Many of them had registration cards in their hands, but their names were not at the polls. They got turned away. And because they were first-time voters and didn't have the presence of mind asked for an affidavit, they just walked away angry, but they were turned away. Then you had the case in Jacksonville, one where Congresswoman Corrine Brown was getting these calls of some hanky panky, and so they were negotiating about 500 violations, 500 ballots. They found out that Friday night, 11 o'clock, that 27,000. Had been wiped away. Now, what's significant about Friday night is you got 72 hours to protest, right? So they held back Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and gave no notice to the congresswoman. So she got the news at 11 o'clock on the news. It was past the protest period. Plus, that was the Friday before Veterans Day. She got Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So it left those 27,000 in the heart of Jacksonville out the loop. You follow what I'm saying? Then you had the case in West Palm. You had the exceptional ballot. We had 4,000 Jewish survivors who voted for Buchanan inadvertently. About 20,000 blacks and Jews who voted punched twice because of confusion. And what Bush is effectively saying, because he's trying to win by the clock and not by a fair count, he's saying, your pain, my gain, I'm your leader. That's the opposite of compassionate conservative. That's the opposite of leave no American behind. When you look at this voter pattern from Liberty City in Miami to Broward County to Rivera Beach to Sanford to Martin to St. Lucie to Orlando, you see a very clear, intentional race profiling pattern. In today's New York Times, on the front page, it shows that New Jersey is now arguing that they learned race profiling from the federal government's drug war on blacks, all right? And secondly, within the paper, it shows that most of the areas of the defective ballots, of the old ballots, were in black areas. The Department of Justice must get involved, and it must act.
Reverend Jackson, we have to end the program right now, but we're going to bring people part two of this conversation tomorrow. We'll go up to the synagogue, Stephen Wise Free Synagogue, where you're going to be speaking today in New York.
Today at high noon here in New York, and Friday morning, a demonstration from the Department of Justice in Washington to the Supreme Court, 9 a.m. Friday morning.
And that's the AFL-CIO and many other religious groups are all going to mobilize in Washington, D.C. Friday.
Indeed.
Friday morning.
Well, I want to thank you all for being with us, including our Lafari Hutchison, Laura Conway, and Jim Ridgway. That does it for the show. Maria Carrion, our producer, Matthew Finch, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
It happens in this nation of landscapes without limits.